You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. That's the song Knights of Sidonia in the background by the band Muse. It's one of many bands I've discovered years after they were cool, of course, when they came up on a streaming service. If you use music streaming platforms like Spotify or Pandora or YouTube, there's a good chance that the algorithm technology built into it has helped you find a new favorite artist or song. And while you can still browse a record shop and pick at random, there are cheaper, faster ways. The ways we search for and discover new music has changed quite a bit since the rise of the internet, not necessarily always for the better. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you discover new music to listen to? Do you use things like Spotify Weekly or YouTube recommendations? Do you get introduced to new artists or songs by friends or maybe on the radio? Or do you shop record stores for something cool and new? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jeremy Morris is an associate professor in media and cultural studies at UW-Madison. Jeremy, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me again.
Can you talk, first of all, about how radically things have changed in the way people discover music these days?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I mean, you mentioned these services like Spotify and iTunes. I mean, the amount of music now that we have access to is great. But the worry, obviously, with having access to that much music is how do you find what you want to listen to or what you might like to listen to? So these services have gotten really good at trying to answer that question for you. And they've sort of positioned themselves as the ones who can uniquely solve that problem, right? We have all these recommendations for you, thanks to all this great technology we're building that can get you to hear a whole bunch of music you never would have been exposed to otherwise.
You and some of your colleagues around the country recently wrote about this, and you did your best to lift up the hood to look at the so-called artificial intelligence, the algorithms that go into those recommendations that we might see on these services. How much do we know about how that works?
Well, yeah, it's really hard to get a full sense of it because a lot of this stuff is proprietary technology. But, you know, there are enough accounts of how these things get built, and there are journalists who are doing a lot of really good work in terms of unearthing how specific practices work. But yeah, you know, I mean, you're looking at a huge combination in sites like Spotify that involve, you know, lots of technology at work, but also lots of people making decisions about what music, you know, should be featured on certain pages, on certain playlists, and all these different features that the services offer. So, you know, there are certainly a lot of technologies at play, but I also like to remind people that there are also always still a lot of humans involved in this process. So part of that report that we talked about was, you know, reminding people that AI, artificial intelligence, or that algorithms are not just technical things, right? They're also highly cultural. They're designed by people. They're created with certain biases in mind about what music means and how music should be discovered. So always thinking about both the technical elements and the cultural elements of algorithms or AI or any technology is important.
That's a point I want to dig into more because we hear this with the use of algorithms in so many spheres of our lives these days, not just music suggestions. And this idea that, well, it's scientific, it's an algorithm, it's objective and unbiased. Can you talk about the human element and how it can really be more biased in some ways?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's any number of ways that bias creeps into the process. I mean, you can think of, about, you know, first of all, the amount of tracks that something like Spotify has access to, right? It may be a huge amount, but there's lots of musics that maybe are not represented on Spotify in the first place. So the algorithms aren't going to capture any songs that aren't being licensed to Spotify or that aren't represented by Spotify. But then also, you know, the people who design these algorithms, design these discovery features are designing them with a particular idea of what it means to listen to music in mind and what music is and what popular music is, right? So a lot of times that may not represent the wide variety of musical cultures that are around the world. So always kind of keeping that in mind when we think about how these algorithms work is pretty important.
Talking to Jeremy Morris from UW-Madison, associate professor in media and cultural studies, looking at how we discover new music. It's changed a lot with the rise of various streaming services, all trying to help us find new music that fits into our already existing preferences and parameters. Love to hear your own examples, 800-642-1234, of how you have discovered music, past or present. maybe going back to the old days. What's your memory of discovering a band that you came to love in a record store, on the radio, from a friend, in a movie soundtrack? Or how did you discover a song or an artist yesterday online? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jeremy, I know another point of concern, and again, that you and your colleagues wrote about, is this idea that, okay, when I use these services, and I do, a picture is being painted of me, and it can allow people to sell things to me, for example. What kind of things do we know about what they know about me when I'm listening to their music?
Right, yeah, and I think, you know, that's a really interesting element of it, right? Like digitization of music, or the turning of music into these kind of streaming services, has really blown music up into millions of data points, right? So every time we, you know, press play, every time we press skip, every time we skip a track, you know, or we dislike a track or like a track, all those things are signals that get fed back into, you know, their profile of us. And, you know, sometimes that profile works out, but other times that profile can get kind of messed up, right? Sometimes you're listening to Spotify with friends and you may be listening to songs that, you know, aren't your favorite. Sometimes your kids are listening, and that can throw off the algorithms as well, right? So there's all these ways, but, you know, again, Spotify's reacting to this, and not just Spotify, but these music services in general are trying to like find that balance between, you know, what are honest and true signals that we are giving the system versus versus which ones might be noise. But, you know, that gets really tricky for a system like Spotify to parse. So anytime we're thinking about what shows up on our playlists or what's being recommended to us, right, we always sort of have that question, okay, why? Why is that being featured to me? Why is it telling me that I should be listening to that song or that band now?
Is this necessarily any better or worse, Jeremy, than, you know, well, once upon a time, this record executive determined what got recorded and produced and marketed in my area, or a radio station executive or a radio station computer in Cincinnati, or whatever the case? Is this different, better, worse? I don't know.
Right. I'm glad you pointed that, because there is certainly a long history of how music has been curated for us. Whether you talk about radio DJs, whether you talk about music producers or A&R reps, right? There are all these technologies and roles in which music gets kind of filtered before it comes to us. So in that sense, yeah, no, Spotify's algorithms are not necessarily different. What they do is they add kind of a new element to that, an element which I'd argue, you know, relies heavily, like you were saying, on personal data, on the giving up of kind of intensely personal details about our own kind of habits with listening to music. And so Spotify is really trying to kind of play on that element of it. Now, whether or not you find that invasive or extremely useful is going to depend on the kind of music consumer you are and your relationship with music in that way, right? So I wouldn't necessarily say it's any better. I'd say music has always come to us as a result of decisions that were partly made by people, but also, you know, decisions or factors that are filtered through the technology that music comes to us through, whether that's the CD, the cassette tape, the radio, right? Any of those things all have their own kind of mechanisms, again, for shaping how we understand music.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jeremy is with us in Cato. Jeremy, hi.
Hey, how you doing? So my comments are, you know, I definitely use the streaming services, but they seem to only, you know, suggest music that's at a, you know, a higher production value. And what I really miss is, you know, back when I was younger, going to check out live shows at places like Concert Cafe in Green Bay, where you'd maybe know one person playing or one band playing, and there'd be like three other bands, you know, and you'd leave with a new DVD or a new CD or a vinyl and, you know, some new music. It's really hard to try and find something new now if you're just using the, you know, Pandoras and things like that.
Jeremy, that's an interesting point. And guest Jeremy Morris, is there a threshold, you know, we're not going to discover that completely unheard of band in our streaming service?
I guess it depends. You know, it really, there's definitely, I'll definitely agree here that one of the things that is problematic about algorithmic recommendation is that you can fall into this loop of like, if I keep listening to the things that sound similar to what I like, then I'm going to keep hearing the same things recommended back to me, right? So we may, you know, our kind of recommendations may be kind of closed in terms of how they come to us, right? I do think, you know, these services do offer a huge amount of music. So, you know, with a bit of poking around and trying to listen to different things, you can start to hear those different recommendations come to you. And yeah, things like Spotify's Discover Weekly playlist start to do that. But yeah, do you miss the ability to find these, you know, this kind of smaller or lesser known artists, right, that don't necessarily have the resources, don't necessarily get as many plays as some of the other bands, right? So I think there's still very much a question about like how Spotify as a global service provider interacts with like local music cultures and what you'd hear, like what Jeremy's describing about, you know, the local bands that may not necessarily be on Spotify or may not be, you know, huge and making a lot of noise on that, enough noise to get recommended onto playlists.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Jeremy Morris, Associate Professor in Media and Cultural Studies at UW-Madison. We're talking about how technology has changed the way we discover new music. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you find new music? Do you use a Spotify Weekly or other playlists generated by Spotify? Do you bounce around on Pandora or YouTube or iTunes or wherever you're getting your music from? Or do you have other ways to discover new stuff? Do you think technology has made it easier to find music you might otherwise have not heard? Or does it just give you more of the same? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation and hear from more of you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Jeremy Morris, Associate Professor in Media and Cultural Studies at UW-Madison. We're talking about streaming technology and how it's changed the way that we discover music. And we want to hear how you discover music at 800-642-1234. Do you remember the first time you heard a band that you love? Was it live at a show? Was it on the radio? Did a friend play it for you on an album or cassette tape or 8-track or CD, or was it streaming? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Ethan is with us in Avon. Ethan, hi.
Hey, how's it going? Just wanted to say that I think Spotify is pretty great. It is limited in certain aspects. I think your previous caller mentioned you get kind of pigeonholed into a really similar artists. For example, I listen to a lot of obscure types of music, progressive and technical mass rock kind of music, and I listen to the more heavy side of things. My girlfriend likes the same bands, and she listens to a little bit of the lighter side, so between the both of us, we get recommended a really broad spectrum, but we both find things that each other would like that we might not have otherwise, you know, found. And also, we find a lot of bands that you just would never have heard about. You know, they have, like, 100 monthly listeners or something like that. And then you can take that away and go follow them on their own pages and purchase their music from them directly. I think that's a great way to kind of bridge the gap between old industry and the new form of listening to music.
Ethan, thanks a lot for sharing that story. I appreciate it. Jeremy, what do you think about Ethan's strategy?
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And I love that point at the end too of, you know, taking it beyond just, oh, I heard this band on Spotify and I like that song, and then, you know, forgetting about it, you know, the next week when we get a new list of recommendations, but, you know, following up, listening, you know, on their other kind of outlets they're participating in, going to the concert, right? Because that's when you also get that other kind of exposure of like, oh, you know, the opening bands that opened for them, right? And I wouldn't be exposed to them either, right? So I think that's one of the great benefits and promises, certainly, of a service like Spotify is that they do have such a wide catalog that you would be recommended songs that you wouldn't necessarily run into every day, right? Whether or not that promise is always true for all listeners is a different question, but certainly, yeah, like the ability to do that and to find those gems that way can be very exciting.
Ethan, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. You can share your musical discovery voyages with us at 800-642-1234. Do you stream? How do you stream? How do you find new stuff? Or do you like other ways of discovering new music? You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. Torsten is with us in Chippewa Falls. Torsten, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. It's all nice to discover all this new music through those streaming services, but you only will be able to hear those musicians if they can make money, and most streaming services pay almost nothing to those musicians. I mean, the worst ones would be Pandora and YouTube, then maybe Spotify in the middle of the road, and the services that pay a bit better, it would be Tidal or and Napster. And the best thing is to buy still CDs from the musicians, because if you want to listen to good music, we have to make sure that musicians can make a living.
Torsten, thanks a lot for bringing that up, Jeremy. Torsten brings up an important point that you and I have talked about in past conversations. What does this all mean for the musicians, especially for the non-huge names, as Torsten was saying, who are hoping to make enough money to keep playing music?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you reminded me that we did talk, because I was like, I think we talked about this in an episode before. But yeah, you know, certainly the royalty structure for streaming services is extremely complicated. You know, artists get paid a percentage of the total streams, you know, so the actual amount that ends up going to an artist given, you know, in a given month or something like that can be quite minimal. I will also say that, you know, even though the CD might be a little bit more in terms of that, the royalty structure there, depending on their record contract, mm-hmm. is still quite out of whack. So, you know, it depends on the artist in terms of what the best way to support them is. You see, luckily now, a lot of new platforms that are trying to make the connection between your donation or your play or your money and the artist receiving that a little bit closer, right? So whether that's tip jars, whether that's straight up donations through some of the channels that they're now able to participate on social media are great ways. Live concerts are another good ways in most cases to support artists. So yeah, I completely agree with everything that's being said there, that's a highly problematic part of the streaming music economy. But again, you know, balancing that with the exposure that these services might offer to artists is something that I know at least some independent musicians find quite helpful.
Thanks for that call, Torsten. Also on the economic side of things, Jeremy, I always wonder, am I hearing this band because somebody paid for me to hear this band, whether a record label or the artists themselves? If a radio station did that, they used to call that payola, and people could go to jail for that. Is that something that's happening behind the scenes for streaming?
Right, and that's really hard to tell a lot of those things. Spotify used to run a feature called Spotlight, and it was a kind of promotion-type deal with independent artists. I'm not sure if they're running it still or if they've rebranded it. In fact, I think they did, because a few weeks ago I saw something in the news on it. But, you know, it was this service where, like, if you were seen to be an up-and-coming artist on Spotify, they would get in touch with you, and they, you know, through some kind of deal, they'd put you in a special part of their website and feature your songs in some playlists. But again, you know, a lot of that stuff that goes on in terms of how and who gets placed on what playlists is not totally transparent to us. So as a listener, definitely asking that question of like, how did that music get there? And is it just there because it sounds like other things that I listen to? Or is it there because, you know, somebody had a vested interest in making it get there? You also have, like you have with Google, you know, search engine optimization. You have companies and artists who get really good at trying to, you know, like play with the metadata of their songs, mess with the keywords in their song titles so that their songs show up in your searches in Spotify before other ones. So that's not necessarily like the person paid to be there, but they are trying to kind of game the system in a particular way.
Time for one more caller. Linda is with us in Rhinelander. Linda, hi.
Hi, how are you? I'm coming to you with a little bit of a different angle, I think, here, and possibly a different generation with a lot less technology in my life. But I religiously listen to CBS Sunday Morning, and they feature a new artist, a new group, or not necessarily new, but new to me. And they give that artist enough time that you can really find out if you like them or not. They interview them and they give them three or four songs to do in a segment. And if I like them and go, wow, I'd like to listen to that, I put them in Pandora and then I follow along with them on that. I really love it.
Linda, thanks a lot for that call. Jeremy, still people reaching out to different media to get their first taste of some artists.
Yeah, no, and I think that's fantastic. And I love the way Linda was talking about context there, right? Like being able to get a bit of the context around the band for some listeners is really important to be like, do I want to invest in this band? Do I want to listen to them more? It's not just, did I like the music? It's like, you know, can I get a sense of the story behind the band as well? But yeah, you know, I think as sort of a closing thought on that, right? Like, if I want to use a bit of the language of algorithms and AI, right? Diversifying the inputs in terms of like how you get new music is always a useful procedure, I think, right? So don't just rely on one particular way of getting it, right? Don't just rely on Spotify's recommendations, right? Talk to your friends about music, you know, go into a record store every once in a while, right? There's all these different means through which, you know, turn on the radio, right? There's all these different means through which we can have songs kind of introduced to us. And I think kind of spreading that out as much as possible will kind of hopefully, you know, give you a bit of a wider exposure there.
Thanks for the call, Linda. It's just our last 30 seconds or so, Jeremy. Would you like to see more transparency for how these algorithms work so we know why we're getting what we're getting?
Yeah, I think more transparency, both in terms of how the algorithms work, but also in terms of, you know, like who's behind the algorithms, right? What are the ideas they have about music and about why they're building the things they're building, right? A lot of that stuff is very opaque to customers, very difficult to see. And so therefore, when we see that music, we're not entirely sure, you know, how it got there and why.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it.
Jeremy Morris is an associate professor in media and cultural studies at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about how technology has changed the way we discover music. You can find a link to some research he's done at wpr.org/centraltime. And you could share your stories of how you discover music over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, recycling has been around as a concept for quite a while. It seems easy enough to do our part as a consumer, separating what's recyclable from our other waste. But are we doing it right? Are we recycling the right stuff, or are we wish-cycling? And are there changes we need to make before we're figuring out how to throw something away? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you ever feel confused about what you can and can't recycle? Do you go to greater lengths to recycle, sorting things extra, making an extra trip somewhere to get that stuff that you can't put out on the curb? Do you try to avoid buying things that are unrecyclable in the first place? And do you have questions about how it all works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jenny Romer is a single-use plastic and recycling expert who helped write plastic bag bans in California and New York. She's a legal associate for the Surfrider Foundation's Plastic Pollution Initiative and has spent more than a decade as a lawyer working on plastic pollution laws. Her new book is called Can I Recycle This? A Guide to Better Recycling and How to Reduce Single-Use Plastics. Jenny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, in your book, Jenny, you get into a lot of the nuts and bolts and specific things, but one big picture emerges and is consistent through your book. It seems like we can recycle a lot less plastic than I think we can. Why is that?
Right. Well, come on. Recycling is a commodities market. And so there's some plastic that's worth a whole lot. And there are buyers and there's an end market for it. So HDPE bottles and jugs, which is resin number two, that's worth almost $1,000 a ton on the commodities market. But three through sevens, that's the majority of what we see on the store shelves, that's only worth about -$17 a ton. So really, if there's no end market, no one that wants to buy all this stuff that we put in our bins, there's not so much of a point of trying to recycle it. So that's a lot of what I try to get across in the book, is that plastic isn't just one thing. So we need to think about that a little bit differently.
Before we get to the stage where we agonize about can I recycle this or not, Jenny, are there changes you'd like to see in the manufacturing process so that the stuff that isn't ultimately going to be recycled doesn't end up on that shelf in the first place?
Definitely. And that's a big take home from the book. You know, I really want people to know what happens after they put items in their bin. But a big take home is policy. And so at the state level, we're seeing a lot of extended producer responsibility laws. People call them EPR laws, where it would make the manufacturers responsible for the cost of recycling and disposal and cleanup of products. And that makes it so that there's a lot of incentives to create more sustainable, more truly recyclable items that end up on store shelves. And then kind of a bigger picture take home is at the federal level, the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act, that includes that type of policy, but then really looks at the whole life cycle of plastics and other materials.
And you have a lot of focus, it even makes it into your subtitle, on single-use plastics. What kind of things are you looking at and why are they of particular concern to you?
Well, my background, as you mentioned, is in plastic bag laws. It's something I kind of stumbled across when I was in law school in San Francisco, and plastic bags were initially being banned there. And I started a website about it right after law school because the plastics industry was just super organized about lobbying to not have those laws pass. And I saw kind of internal PowerPoints where they saw it as a gateway to broader restrictions on plastics. And so I really got involved there and helped pass a lot of policies and really figured out what works and what doesn't as far as banning plastic bags or putting a fee on plastic bags. And then really learned a lot more about how the recycling system works. And plastic bags in particular are tanglers in curbside recycling programs. So they end up tangling a lot of that sorting machinery. So not only do they not really have an end market, no one really wants to buy those bags that end up in the curbside bins, but they also cause a lot of havoc at recycling facilities. So that's one thing that we look to really reduce rather than recycle.
Talking to Jenny Romer about her new book, Can I Recycle This? A Guide to Better Recycling and How to Reduce Single-Use Plastics. You can join in with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. All right, Jenny, let's take us to a kind of question that I know you get asked a lot, the Can I Recycle This? And often, and I'll speak for myself, I've been in that position, I'm not sure, it's in that gray area. I'm best off erring on the side of caution. I'll put it in the recycling bin. And if it's no problem, if they can't recycle, they'll just take it out. I'm making the wrong decision, it sounds like. Tell me why.
Well, it depends. I really want people to get to know their local recycling rules. So your local jurisdiction has made decisions about what they want to accept in the bin. For example, in New York City accepts all rigid plastics in their residential curbside bins, but they know that they can only really sell a certain portion of them. And so they'll accept everything to make it easy for the consumer. And they know that they are not going to have a buyer for quite everything. But then some jurisdictions will only accept number one and number two bottles and jugs because they know there's a market for that. So first thing, pay attention to what your facility wants you to recycle. But then all this book really helps you get to know what happens next. So to make better choices when you're at the market, when you're making purchases, to not buy things or try to avoid as much as you can buying things that are not recyclable, and really avoiding those things that are tanglers that really hurt the recycling system.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Oconomowoc. Mike, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. The one thing I noticed after moving back here from North Carolina was how limited Wisconsin has recycling programs and how difficult it is to recycle so many things that when I was in North Carolina was very easy to recycle, particularly electronics. There's just doesn't seem to be any place to take anything, whereas down there, there was a very well-networked recycling system throughout the whole Charlotte and Raleigh areas that made it very easy for people to bring recyclables, divide them up themselves, and take them to the appropriate places rather than just putting them in a blue bin and hoping that they make it through the recycling system.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And I know that varies not just from state to state, but from, you know, city to city here in Wisconsin. Jenny, can you talk about why communities might be making different decisions and offering different options?
Sure. Well, a lot of it depends on policy. So some states have zero waste goals at the state level that determine that could put requirements then on the local level for what they kind of what recycling goals they need to meet. So that has a lot to do with it. A lot of it depends on the kind of the political will or what's happening at the local level and where you live. But another thing is that recycling can be expensive. It depends on what you're trying to recycle. But sometimes if your local recycler isn't making money in the process, for a long time, municipal recyclers were making money by selling low value plastics or electronics that were being shipped abroad. But now we're seeing more regulation and really a lot more eyes on that issue as far as really that it's a humanitarian issue. When we're sending our electronics or our low-value plastics abroad. So some places are doing it or are not accepting them because they're not going to be recycled domestically. So that's one thing to look at. But I would say that generally it's something that is going to be decided probably at the state level, how much you're seeing kind of trickle down to the local level in most places.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Paul now in Delafield. Paul, hi.
Howdy. Thanks for taking my call. So one of the things we do, we do like to recycle, but one of the things that I see happening is that when they pick up the recycle things in their trucks, if it's not secured, like a lot of it blows around, and after recycle day, you see a bunch of plastic out in the lawns and stuff. So I end up putting my recycle stuff in plastic bags that I tie so they don't blow around. But is that a good habit or should I get over that?
Well, thanks for the call, Jenny.
I think you should try to get over it. It's, you know, something that maybe you can bring up with your local hauler, because it should have a way to capture those plastics before they get out into the environment from being hauled. But generally, like I said, plastic bags are tanglers at facilities. There are some facilities that who know they're going to get a lot of plastic bags regardless, or who require that you put your recyclables into plastic bags, particularly in really dense cities where there isn't room for what we call toters or garbage cans, recycling cans. And so in those places, there'll usually be kind of a vacuum suction at the beginning of a sorting line so that those plastics are kind of sucked off and held and taken out of the recycling stream. But most places, those plastic bags are kind of just going to get stuck in the machinery. So do your best to avoid it. And I would say if you want to make a difference, try to reach out to your hauler about that problem.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Jenny Romer about her new book. It's called Can I Recycle This? A Guide to Better Recycling and How to Reduce Single-Use Plastics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What burning recycling questions do you have about what can and can't be recycled and about how the recycling business works in general? And do you make an effort to buy things that you know can be reused or recycled as opposed to stuff you know you're going to end up throwing out? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Join us for Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Certain parts of his brain light up when he does that.
Beta is a polyphonic mosh pit where high culture and low culture collide.
Coming out of the gate.
We take an immersive, innovative, playful, and provocative approach to exploring arts, culture, and technology. Saturday at 11 and Sunday at 8 on the Ideas Network.
The 2011 political district map changed the game for Wisconsin.
You know, it was pretty much of a Democratic landsliding. You know, we got wiped out. And then somebody said to me, well, don't worry, we're still in control of the assembly. I said, how can that be?
Listen to WPR Reports Mapped Out and find out why maps matter so much. It's at WPR.org/mapped out or wherever you get your podcasts.
Running a business requires smart decisions every day. Make a good decision for your company today and reach other businesses through Wisconsin Public Radio sponsorship. For more information, call Jay Johnston at 414-202-1961.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up our talk with single-use plastic and recycling expert Jenny Romer about her new book, Can I Recycle This? You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Jenny, before we go back to our caller, you introduced me to a new word in this book. You dig into the sort of the life cycle of recycling, including of plastic, the nurdle, N-U-R-D-L-E. What is a nurdle?
A nurdle is a pre-production plastic pellet. So it's what kind of the base for what plastic items are made from. And so that's the nurdles have been in the news a bit lately because plastic production facilities have had very large nurdle spills. So even before plastic becomes an item and is used, they're getting into the environment just at the production level. And so there have been some laws proposed in Texas and other places to regulate them. So if you're at the beach sometime and you see, or even in the Great Lakes, if you see little tiny bits of plastic, it could be a nurdle.
Let's go back to our callers now. Colleen is with us in Madison. Colleen, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what'd you want to bring up, Colleen?
Well, I'm going to focus on two things. One is that I just came from California, where I was living for many years. I'm from Madison. And I would say I cannot take any credit, but the plastic bags in grocery stores was made illegal. And also styrofoam on takeout food was also prohibited in my town. But it seems like, and now that I have a word, it seems like the nurdle production is fixed, so that almost exactly at the same time, food that is in the grocery stores started to become present in pouches. So even like rice products that come in burlap or cloth sacks suddenly, or even paper, suddenly they were put into these pouches, and the pouches were, they had a photograph of a burlap bag or a cloth bag, like the Japanese rice, that would be printed on the plastic pouch. That these can't be recycled. Also, there's a trend, and especially in the town that I lived in, to have rows and rows of organic, blended, pure vegetables in pouches. And then when you go to the parks, you see the caps for these pouches and the pouches themselves thrown all about and in the garbage cans.
Thanks a lot for the call. Jenny, Colleen says, hey, they got rid of the single-use plastic bags, but saw more and more products ending up wrapped in plastic.
Yeah, that's really a worldwide phenomena, the multi-layer pouches, particularly single-use multi-layer pouches. So just moving from buying in bulk or buying a 10-pound bag of something to buying smaller sizes and having it be in what we call multi-layer pouches. So pretend to be a couple of different types of plastic and maybe some aluminum. And one general rule for recycling is if something is made from multiple materials, it's not going to be recyclable. If it's made from all these things, there's kind of one exception is milk cartons. Milk cartons tend to be, like some are made from kind of Tetra Paks, which are generally not recyclable except for the paper layer. And then the paper layer of regular milk cartons have a paper layer and then both plastic on both sides. And so only the paper fibers from those are recyclable. But for the most part, multi-layer pouches are a huge problem. You see them for baby food, and they're definitely not recyclable. And I agree with the caller. We're starting to address certain things. And we've gotten a really good handle on things like plastic bags and foam foodware, where those laws are allowed. But we're seeing a lot more single-use items on the grocery store shelves. And I will say, in Wisconsin, there is a preemption law in place at the state level. So local jurisdictions are not allowed to adopt plastic bag laws. So that's a whole other subject, but just to raise that. And that's something we've seen in about 18 states now, where the plastics industry, rather than dealing with these local laws popping up to put a fee or ban plastic bags or ban foam foodware, just going to the state level and blocking that. And I'll also say, I just completed a map of all plastic bag, foam, and straw laws in the US at Surfrider. So if you go to Surfrider's website, there's a beautiful map of almost 1,000 laws that have been adopted in the US to reduce single-use plastics.
Thanks for the call, Colleen. We'll go next to Pat in River West. Pat, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just recently watched, I came into this program late, but I recently watched a NPR show about the kind of the sham of the recycling emblem that, you know, that makes us all feel good about the triangle with the 1, 2, 3, 4. And you feel better when you see they recycle all the numbers. But they said that was designed by the plastic petroleum companies in the 70s. And in their internal documents, it said that this won't be it won't be utilized because it just doesn't cost, it's not cost effective. It takes more energy and chemicals to recycle plastic. So really plastic is, it's getting cheaper and cheaper with these factories that make these plastic pellets and stuff, but it's a sham to utilize petroleum waste. And really we should be going for glass or paper. I mean, I won't buy anything if it's the best chocolate creamer in a plastic bottle. I don't buy plastic anymore. I'll buy a half as good, product in glass, Annie's, mm-hmm. Annie's salad dressing, Oberweis chocolate milk. I will not buy, I'll starve before I buy something in plastic, or I'll buy even another water bottle.
Thanks a lot for the call. Jenny, Pat seeking to use anything but plastic in his products.
Yeah, that's great to hear. And I really want to take home from the book for people to understand what's happening to these items and to make choices when they're at the supermarket and in other parts of their lives. And this book definitely gets into the history of the recycling, the chasing arrows symbol, and how the plastics industry has really spent so much money and so much effort, as that Frontline documentary talks about, really going into the plastics industry has spent millions of dollars over decades on marketing to make us feel really good about recycling when they knew the whole time that a lot of these things cannot actually be recycled. It's not an efficient system for the low value plastics. So my book really looks at kind of a three-step process that the Federal Trade Commission's guideline for whether something can be marketed as recyclable. And so that means it must be collected, that item must be collected in at least 60% of consumers would have access to collection. It would be sorted by existing infrastructure, and there would be an end market, a buyer, to make that into a new product. And so that's a pretty strict definition of recycling, but it is a very valid, accurate, I think everyone should think of recycling as, will someone buy this and manufacture it into a new product? And that documentary really looks at that as well.
Jenny, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jenny Romer, legal associate for the Surfrider Foundation's Plastic Pollution Initiative. We talked to her today about her new book. It's called Can I Recycle This? A Guide to Better Recycling and How to Reduce Single-Use Plastics. Still time for you to share your recycling stories, the efforts you make to make sure things don't go to waste. You can do that online over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR.